You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
Up.
I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, a rock time capsule of an embryonic band making the leap from London cult band to stadium filler.
You know, he was always a rock star. He really was. That's the funny thing. He was a very shy boy, very shy, very insecure, I would say, you know, and came from a very strict public school upbringing. Very kind of repressed in a sense, and so his reaction to that was to go completely the other way, to be completely outrageous and build a character around himself, which he inhabited. And it came to its climax when he actually changed his name as well and became Freddie Mercury instead of Bulsara.
Keep yourself alive, keep yourself alive. We'll take you on your time and money, honey, you'll survive.
God, Freddie is a completely self-made man. He had his vision, he had his dream, and he constructed everything about his life to make this dream happen. And we were part of this whole kind of journey.
Now I'm here, I'm here.
This is Brian May.
Hi, and I'm Roger Taylor. We're from Queen.
And we're in the studio with Redbeard, of course.
Definitely evolving between Queen 2 and Jihad Attack. And I had a copy of The Rainbow, Live at the Rainbow. And I had it in my car. I was on the way to rehearsals the first day. And I said, Brian, look, these tracks sound great. You know, I'd forgotten that we were a really heavy band.
She's a killer, queen, gunpowder, chelsea, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind.
No, there weren't any tricks to be had, no. It was all live and dangerous, as it is now with us. We knew what we were doing in those days. We were very clear, and we were very well oiled, in a sense. You know, we knew each other already very well. We'd worked hard on getting the coherence of the band. And I think we were lucky. You know, we're lucky that we found each other, because nobody could put together a band like that. It had to happen organically. We had to find each other somehow, naturally. And, you know, and we had Freddie. Boy, oh boy.
Hi, this is Roger Taylor of Queen in the studio for Queen Live at the Rainbow 74.
Hi folks, this is Brian May of Queen. I'm in the studio for Queen Live at the Rainbow 74.
I know it's difficult to remember a time when Queen was not one of the world's most popular bands. From 1975 on through the 1980s, Queen strung together a series of hit albums that has resulted in sales so monumentally huge that they are rivaled only by the Beatles. But a musical time capsule has been discovered of Queen, perfectly preserved, of the exact nine-month period in 1974 when Brian May, Roger Taylor, John Deacon, and Freddie Mercury made the bold leap from London cult band to stadium fillers. These terrific-sounding tapes are from Queen's first headline show in March 1974 at London's venerable Rainbow Theatre, and then again the following November. You can actually experience a white-hot band going into supernova and a star being born. On the North American leg of Queen's tour with Adam Lambert, I spoke to drummer-singer Roger Taylor about Queen Live at the Rainbow 74.
The thing is, you can draw a straight line from what you were doing after the second album and right as Sheer Heart Attack
just
was coming out.
Just before the Sheer Heart Attack album.
You can draw a straight line from that to what I just, and what you just performed and I just witnessed last night. That's amazing.
Yeah, I guess it is. I mean, we include in our act now, we're including some of those early songs.
I know.
And the reason is that I had a copy. I hadn't heard this stuff for 40 years. And I had a copy of The Rainbow, Live at the Rainbow. And I had it in my car. I was on the way to rehearsals the first day. And I said, Brian, look, these tracks sound great. You know, why don't we do some of this really extra stuff? I'd forgotten that we were a really heavy band. We were, you know, before we'd had any hits, sort of pop hits, we were a heavy band, and that really is accentuated on those tracks.
You can hear the progression from when you played The Rainbow in March, which is on disc one, is an entire set, and disc two is November, and I've got written in my notes here, heavier sound in November.
Yeah, yeah.
You're still evolving.
I think we were definitely evolving between Queen 2 and Sheer Heart Attack, which I think is one of my favourite albums, but I had forgotten that we were a heavy act.
A voice and a spirited romp originally on their debut called Keep Yourself Alive, a song which would soon become a case of life imitating art for at least one band member, which we'll hear later. Here's guitarist, singer, songwriter Brian May.
You were just lads. We were just
boys.
Yeah, but you were a good live band.
Yeah, I think we were pretty good looking.
And
back
there were no tricks back then.
No, there weren't any tricks to be had. No, it was all live and dangerous as it is now with us, you know, and we're pretty proud of that. But yeah, we looked back and I think we were a little nervous once the tapes came out of the box, you know, thinking, what on earth are we going to sound like? But Roger and I were both pretty shocked. We thought, yeah, actually, We knew what we were doing in those days. We were very clear and we were very well oiled in a sense. You know, we knew each other already very well. We'd worked hard on getting the coherence of the band. And I think we were lucky. You know, we're lucky that we found each other because nobody could put together a band like that. It had to happen organically. We had to find each other somehow, naturally. And we shared that vision and we shared a work ethic already. And, you know, and we had Freddie. Boy, oh boy.
That was his secret weapon, wasn't it?
Boy, oh boy. But also we had John, you know, people forget, you know, what an extraordinary link in the chain he was. You know, we were very interactive and the four of us all had a great influence on each other and on the eventual outcome. So it was a magical combination and, you know, yeah.
How did that come together that your first time you headlined the Rainbow, that there was people filming it and recording it professionally? That's expensive. It's yeah. bulky back then. It was hard to do back then.
Well, I'm not going to claim credit, but we had an overall kind of ethos that it was always worth investing in ourselves and the future. So everything was a gamble. We would... already deeply in debt, but we were always thinking, well, it's worth spending the money now. We don't need to be making money now. We need to be investing in the growth of what we've put together. So there was never any question. And I don't think we made a profit on a tour until the last one, the one wherein we did Wembley, 1986. I don't think we ever made an overall profit because we spent so much on the tour.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's right. And we were making money off the records. In those days, you could. I don't know if you can these days. Right. But in those days, yeah, we just put everything we could into the tour, investing in great toys and great people. You know, people are worth looking after and paying well, you know. So hopefully we always looked after people. And we always had the state-of-the-art gear and thought it was worth it. And if the balance at the end of the tour was like in the red, that was okay because we sold records and we had the experience and we were building for the future.
I'm told that there were some doubting Thomasons, some naysayers that were actually saying in the very powerful English music press,
yeah,
that they thought that you weren't quite going to be quite ready before the show in March at the Rainbow.
Well, probably. I mean, we did use that. The English music press was a very strange animal. It was both powerful and fiercely fashion conscious. It would switch allegiances in a few days, and very vitriolic. And I think that was the way that the young journalists. In the English music press, they saw themselves as the creators of a scene.
Kingmakers.
And I think...
Or in your case, queenmakers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think they sort of used this sort of sarcasm and vitriol to sort of show off as writers, I think, really. And it was more about presenting themselves as witty observers of the zeitgeist than it was actual really meaningful criticism, you know, so I take it all with a pinch of salt.
Of course. Now, just before you did that March show at the Rainbow in 74, you had done a rather high-profile tour in support of Mott.
Yes, yeah.
Do you remember some of the reviews that Queen got as on the same stage with Mott?
Well, I just remember the tours being such fun.
Oh, good.
And such a learning experience for us. Obviously, you know, we tried to give them a run for their money every night, but they were a good live act.
They had a very partisan crowd.
Yeah, absolutely.
Loved them to death.
Yeah, and actually who we went down pretty well with, you know. But it was great. It was a learning experience for us as well. We did learn from them. Ian Hunter, their lead singer, had a great sense of drama and theatrical presentation in a totally rock and roll context, and we loved that, and I think we probably nicked a bit of that, you know, and simple lighting ideas, you know, which not a lot of people were aware of at the time.
How did you find yourself now, early 74, once again a couple of months before you would have headlined the Rainbow for the first time, how did you find yourself on the telly? How did you get on Top of the Pops?
I gather the story goes, I think David Bowie had to pull out because I think he was sick or something. And And so we suddenly got this, get to the BBC, you've got a Top of the Pop slot. And we got to the BBC and we shot it because they were on strike. The cameraman or somebody was on strike at the BBC. So it wasn't in the normal big studio with the kids and everything. It was shot in the weather studio. With the, so there were four cameras and
so
us.
You got that to fall back on.
In a room 20 feet square, you know. And that was our first appearance on national TV. And but, you know, Freddie acted it up and we were all dressed to the nines and, you know, in this sort of black and black and more black and shiny black, matte black, everything, you know, everything black. But it had a great effect because I think it came over as being slightly dangerous, you know, fear me, you lords and lady preachers. Fear me, your parents out there. It was more like it, I think. But it was a great start for us. That was the first sort of sniff of a hit.
Yesterday, my life was in ruin. Now today, I know what I'm doing. Got a feeling I should be doing all right.
Still to come, a serious health crisis almost turns fatal for young Brian May. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Queen's Roger Taylor and Brian May.
Hi, this is Roger Taylor of Queen in the studio.
Hello, folks. This is Brian May speaking to Redbeard, and I'm in the studio for Queen.
Thank you, gentlemen. A real treat. The summer of 1974, after Queen first headlined at the Rainbow Theater, was a pivotal time for the band, according to Queen singing drummer Roger Taylor.
I think you alluded to this a moment ago, but how big a venue, who had played there, about the prestige factor of headlining the Rainbow Theater?
Yeah, well, it was, in those days, shows weren't, you know, they were, stadium shows didn't really exist.
No.
It's hard to imagine, actually, but so these big old theaters, it's about 3,000 people, you know, not huge by a lot of standards, but with an enormous, beautiful proscenium arch with a complete Spanish village over the top of it.
And great acoustics.
Yeah, and great acoustics. So they were the top venues, really. There was that one, and there was what was called the Hammersmith Odeon. They were probably the two top venues in London at the time. And the Rainbow had a slightly cooler thing. David Bowie played there. I saw Eric Clapton and people like that.
That's,
you know,
right. He did do a show.
Yeah. That's right. Well, we were halfway between albums at the time. You know, we'd done Queen 2 and we were about to do Cheer. I think we maybe started Cheer Heart Attack. So, yeah, it was, I guess it was a sort of a bit of a hotbed of creative activity at the time. And we were quite excited. We could see results, you know, and we were quite ambitious with the show. And although, you know, these days, that, I mean, that, it's a small show. But for those days, you know, I mean, very few bands were dressing up unless they were going the whole kind of glam look, you know. But we weren't that. We were sort of darker than that. You know?
Good point. What do you attribute the fantastic recorded quality that you got on that night? I mean, it's a hand-in-glove kind of a thing. You have to have a really good band, because there were no tricks back then.
No.
Yeah, there was no place to hide.
Oh, that's absolutely right, yeah. There were no tricks. I mean, I think we had... I mean, Brian, I noticed how well Brian was playing, how crisp and
but your toms sound fabulous.
Yeah, they sound, that big, fat sound.
Okay, darlings, this is a little delicate little number called White Queen. So sad, her eyes smiling, dark eyes. So sad, her eyes, as if began. What such a breathless night is this? On my brow, the lightest kiss. I walked alone. My lady soon will stir this way, and sorrow no more. The White Queen walks, and the night grows pale. Stars of lovingness in her hair, leaping on heart. Lily Fair would have thee seen, the mother of the Willow Queen. I called her name. Beneath the window have I stayed. I love the footsteps that she made, and when she came,
again, Roger Taylor of Queen with me in the studio.
It begs the question in general, before we get to any specifics, why? How could something that good sit on the shelf for 40 years? Was it entangled legally? Was there some technical?
I think there might have been something like that, but... You know, and then I think there were some difficulties with the management.
Because you had that was your first management, right?
Of course, we sort of moved on mentally and forgot about it. But life seems to fall on the flip of a coin, doesn't it, sometimes?
Yes, it does. And of course it does.
You know, imagine if the Who had, live at Leeds was a very sort of casual thing, I think.
It was.
Had that not come out, I think that was a major thing for them. But I gather it was very much a sort of slung together project.
You're absolutely right. I've asked Pete about it at length.
Yeah, for a lot of people, that was a turning point with The Who, you know, and one of my favorite bands of all time.
And mine as well.
Yeah.
Before taking the stage to headline the Rainbow in March 74 for the first time, what reasons did you have for being so bold? What had transpired to date to make you think that you were ready, that Queen was ready?
Well, it's interesting. It was a prestigious place to play in London at the time. It's a beautiful old theatre, and I don't know. I think we did have a certain inbuilt collective arrogance, I think it was the group thing, you know, it was just being a group. Individually, I don't think we were arrogant, but as a group, we thought we could sort of conquer anything. And to have that belief is like a necessary ingredient, I think. I mean, not always the most attractive thing, but I think you have to think that you're good. You know, shrinking violets are unlikely to succeed.
Not in this business.
I think.
Yeah. Here I stand, here I stand, looked around, 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 around. But you won't see me,
but you won't see me.
Now I'm here.
Spectacular performance and top-notch sound on Now I'm Here, originally on the then-new third album Sheer Heart Attack. To get noticed in London, Queen was vying for press attention at a time when the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin were neck and neck for world's greatest rock band.
Plus, it was the absolute peak for progressive rock. Bands like Yes and the Moody Blues and Jethro Tull had number one albums, as well as David Bowie and the glam bands. This I reminded to Queen's Brian May.
Then you were elbowing at the bar for a column in the music press back then.
Well, I don't know. You know, the music press was never our friend. You know, we were always sort of fighting, like you say, with the press, who for some reason thought we were insignificant on the whole, you know, with a couple of exceptions. I don't think we regarded it as a competition, but we had a kind of pioneering spirit. You know, we thought we were great. You know, we were precocious boys. We thought we had something exceptional to offer, and we never questioned it. So internally, we had a great strength, a great belief. But England was very, you know, we were in England. We weren't in the world at that time, really. We hadn't really started in the world. We were just in the UK. And Britain is very fashion conscious. Britain works on waves of fashion, sort of, which seem to be, it still works that way.
Really?
I think. Yeah, I think so. You know, something will be the thing at a particular time and everybody will jump on a bandwagon and that will be cool and nothing else will be cool. So, and to that kind of, in that context, we weren't very cool. We were doing something which was sort of outside whatever the trend was. So we weren't selling thousands and millions of records. But in the live situation, we had a lot of believers and we were building the live thing. But it doesn't happen overnight. You know, there was no internet in those days. There was no, you know, things were so different. There was not even any mobile phones when you think about it.
There was no rock on TV in America.
No, there was no, wheels were square in those days, you know.
That's good.
No, but you know, it was vastly different in those days. And we did it what was really the classic way. We did it by constantly touring, constantly playing, partly because we loved it. We liked that feeling. But partly because that was how to pay your dues and that was how to build yourself as a band. And complementing that was the studio album, which happened every year. You know, we would spend probably 3 months making the album and roughly 9 months touring, if you check back.
Wow.
That was life for us. And we loved it. We thought we were lucky, and we were. Yeah.
Truth be told, history came perilously close to being rewritten for Queen that summer 74. Here's guitarist, singer, songwriter Brian May.
Plus, I got very sick. You know, there was all that going on. You know,
what happened?
I somehow got hepatitis when we were doing that first support tour with Mott the Hoople.
Oh, with Mott. And so how do you deal over the spring and summer with a serious illness?
Well, we got to New York, which was one of the pinnacles, and did the Eurys Theatre, thank God. sort of a Broadway kind of expedition for Mott, which we shared, and you know, it was good of them to share it with us, really. And then off we went to Boston, and I woke up completely yellow.
Oh my!
And feeling really, really bad.
Jaundiced.
Yeah, and nobody knows how it happened. I don't know how I got that hepatitis thing.
It happens just from close quarters. It happens to kids when they go away to college and they live in a dorm room together.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. So they shipped me back home, and that was the end of that tour, which was really sad for everybody. But, you know, everyone dealt with it really well. I didn't get any resentment from the rest of them. And then following that, I was sort of recovering from that, and then we started work on the album. And I was thrown up few times a day.
Oh, man.
And we started thinking, well, this is not the hepatitis. I'm sort of over that. What is this? And I ended up on the floor of this specialist's clinic in a bad way. And he said, I think we better take you in. And in King's College Hospital, they operated on me the next day because I had basically... an extreme form of ulceration of the stomach.
Mm.
And it was
you
extreme.
You can die from that.
I would have died without a doubt.
Bleed internally.
Yeah, well, not just that, but also, if you want to know the details, there was so much ulceration, which had been going on since I'd been a child, apparently,
really?
That nothing was getting through my body, basically.
Gosh.
So I was eating food, and it couldn't get out.
Oh.
So it had to come back up. Are you enjoying this explanation?
Bless your heart.
Yeah, so I was no wonder I was in a pitiful state, you know. So they fixed it up. They sort of replumbed my insides. And
I didn't realize that you'd had surgery.
Between these
2 dates and done a studio, your best studio album to date in Sheer Heart Attack.
Yeah, well, there's an irony in the Sheer Heart Attack title there, you know, because I owe my life to those people.
Wow.
In King's College. So that was quite serious. And I was in hospital, and we were halfway through the album, so Freddie and Roger and John would pop in and make me laugh, which would almost
hurt.
Kill me because I had this huge incision down my middle.
Don't make me laugh.
Yeah, don't make me laugh, guys. Oh, thanks. And but they brought me in the tapes of what they were doing, and they were continuing with the record. But I remember Freddie saying, don't worry, darling, you know, we're not going to finish it without you. We need you back. Freddie was great. He was very supportive, always, you know, he's very caring.
She keeps a Moët Chandon in a pretty cabinet. Let them eat cakes, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. A building, a remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy. At any time, an invitation you can't decline. Caviar and cigarettes, well-versed in etiquette, extraordinarily. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Recommended at the price, insatiable in appetite. Wanna try? She never kept the same address. In conversation, she spoke just like a baroness. Middleman from China went down to Geisha Minor. Then again, incidentally, she that way. Perfume came naturally from Paris. Naturally. Because she couldn't care less. Fastidious and precise. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam. Guaranteed to blow your mind. Momentarily out of action, temporarily out of class, so absolutely dry. She's out to get you. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, gelatine,
insatiable an appetite.
Wanna try?
Roger Taylor credits one song as critical to their development.
Suddenly, yeah. You've got a hit, your first one on yeah. both sides of the pond with yeah. Killer Queen.
With Killer Queen, yeah. And Killer Queen was a real quality record. And we put a lot of effort into making the harmonies sit right. And they're quite intelligent harmonies. So I think it was a very fine, sophisticated song, and for those reasons I think it was a fairly unstoppable hit. It just, when we did it, we thought, that sounds like a hit record, and we didn't think about particularly making singles then. We were an albums band, so we never really weren't aiming for singles, but just the way that turned out, it just sounded so infectious and
undeniable.
Yeah.
This next song has turned into a duet. That's the way we like it, I think. We'd like everybody to join in. This is a song called Love of My Life.
guitarist Brian May credits an earlier tour supporting Mott the Hoople as very educational in several ways.
With Mott the Hoople, you know, Mott were great for us. They were a great example for us of, as to how you live on the road. You know, how to be a rock star.
A few easy lessons.
They were fabulous, Mott. I mean, I feel sad, actually, when I think of Mott, because they should have been the biggest band in the world at some point. You know, and they blew it by splitting up. You know, that's rule number one. You do not split up, you know, because you have to realize that as a group you're greater than the sum of your parts. Right. You know, and it's classic. And they were fantastic on that tour. I remember watching them do All the Way from Memphis in Memphis, and the place erupted. You know, it was just, they were insane. And
that's the night that after the show, Ian went to Graceland and went over the fence.
Yes, that's right.
One of the best stories I ever
heard.
That's
a good story. There's some stories which have never been told, really, about what happened in the Holiday Inn next to the Mississippi down there. It was incredible, you know, and it blew all our minds. And we sort of were baptized into the world of living on the road as rock and roll heroes, I was going to say. We weren't exactly heroes in those days, but it was fantastic because we were pitched right into the middle of it. And on and off stage, it was full on, 1,000,000% full on rock and roll.
In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Roger Taylor and Brian May.
Hi, this is Roger Taylor of Queen in the studio.
Hello, folks. This is Brian May speaking to Redbeard, and I'm in the studio for Queen.
Again, my pleasure, guys.
People didn't have recording studios in their home. They didn't have remote gear.
That's right.
Well, you have a rack set up and push one button and suddenly everything sounds
yes,
great.
Yes, so true. Everything was
hard and expensive.
Yeah, and big.
And big.
And, you know.
Big and bulky. And heavy.
Yeah. I mean, there's more technology in your phone now than there was in all of our trucks put together, you know, in those days.
Hard to imagine.
And lighting as well. It's all the same. You know, everything is smaller, more efficient, and I guess better, but With the quite a few exceptions, I'd say analog recording on tape still sounds better than, you know, recording digitally.
Yeah. The thing I'm trying to get to is that you were looking like you had your first big hit, but the check wasn't in the mail yet. The bank account wasn't
check
full.
Wasn't in the mail this for a long time.
This is exactly, yeah. And this is expensive and bold, and someone has to really commit a lot of money and because I know I'm getting ahead of myself, but if you recall going into Night at the Opera, you guys were busted broke. You were skint. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I remember we had very little money.
And is this part, things like this, you think part of the reason that added up, all this was speculative, trying to launch your career?
It was entire speculation. Really, if you look back, there was no guarantee they were ever going to get any money back on that. And a Night at the Opera, I mean, the fact that the Sheer Heart Attack was a hit album, quite a big hit, we didn't see any money. And I think that, you know, it just sort of magically disappeared into our bank manager's swimming pool, I think. Yeah. But into our manager's swimming pool and his new Rolls Royce. But so when we recorded A Night at the Opera, we were broke, and it was such a gamble, and we knew that this is it, you know, this better work, and especially with a song like Bohemian Rhapsody, it's such a chance to take.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy, I need no sympathy. Because I'm easy come, easy go, little high, little law. Anyway, the wind blows, doesn't really matter to me. To me,
Mama just killed a man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger. Now he's just begun, but now I've gone and thrown it all away. Mama, didn't mean to make you cry. If I'm not back again this time tomorrow, carry on, carry on, as if nothing really matters. Too late, my time has come. Sent shivers down my spine, body's aching all the time. Oh,
see a little silhouette of a man.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango?
Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo,
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 Galileo Figaro.
Magnifico.
I'm just a poor boy, nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family. Spare him his life from this monstrosity.
Easy come, easy go, will you let me go?
Bismillah!
No, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah!
We will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah!
We will not let you go.
Let me go!
We will not let you go.
Let me
never,
go.
Never, never let you go.
Never let me go! Mamma mia, mamma mia.
Mamma mia, let me go. Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me. For me. For me.
Renbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Roger Taylor and Brian May of Queen. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014. All rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net.